stretch out, then your skin can bring you so much pain. Now I hear you say, you got the best of both ways. Won't you come and take a walk in my shoes and tell me if you take my place? Under the cover of my skin, welcome listeners, this is Kate Smythe and I'm joined here today by Richie Bennett. We're really fortunate to have Richie with us today. Richie is a sports psychologist. He's got so many decades of experience and I'm so looking forward to picking his brain today. Just in case you haven't heard of Rich before, he has worked with a number of games teams, the Olympic, Paralympic, Commonwealth Games teams. He started off his career in Indigenous mental health and then You kind of ventured into a number of different areas, didn't you? Both in corporate, healthcare, military. You've worked with all kinds of elite performers, both in sport and in career. And these days, you've got a really interesting position working at with AFL umpires. Yeah. As well, which is awesome. So welcome, Rich.
Thanks, Kate.
For everyone's benefit and understanding, Rich also is a poet and an author, and he has written several books, including the one right in front of me, which we're going to touch on, called The Surfer's Mind today. And a lot of there's a lot of overlap between what runners go through and what surfers go through in terms of sports performance and indeed across all sports, which Rich is going to elaborate on today. So welcome, Rich, and thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Kate. Hi, everyone.
So, Rich, you've had an amazing career working with so many awesome men and women. And you've been on the pro surfing circuit as well, traveling the world and having a great time. Rich is also a surfer himself. And you've worked in institutes of sport and you've done some incredible things. What are some of the highlights that you've come across in your journey working with athletes?
Well, interestingly, like in the very beginning of my career working in community mental health and Indigenous mental health, that's still a great highlight of mine because it was not only the beginning of me developing, you know, fundamental skills in psychology and the actual practice of psychology, it was a really wonderful alignment of understanding the human and the human and what our human experience is and what our human nature and potential is when we're in extreme situations. Mm. So you can imagine in the mental health situation, you know, my very first call out was a failed suicide attempt. And my intense experiences there. And then there's the family around the person and managing that emotional experience with those people. And then at the same time, my first client was very long-term schizophrenia. And when I first started working with him, he'd been in his room for 23 and a half hours a day for a couple of years, pretty much, entertained by symptoms and having negative symptoms, withdrawal, avolition, that kind of thing. And he'd just come out for a little bit of food and toileting, and that was about it. So I, in that clinical setting, it sounds unusual, but I had every day for 3 years, I had situations where it was quite intense. Mm. And then other situations where it was long-term work. You know, the gentleman I just shared about, I would see him 2 to 4 times a week and we would walk and talk. We'd go to the beaches and the bush. Mm. Well, it was kind of one way for the first 6 months. That gentleman didn't say a word to me for a good 6 months. But what actually happened, how I started relating that to sport and performance, you know, because I did sport psychology in my university studies, and that was an intention to get into that area. What I noticed was that, you know, athletes are performing at the extreme end of human experience, but ideally by choices and good choices. And some of the people I was working with in Portland were experiencing at the extreme end of human emotion and thoughts.
But without the choice, necessarily.
But sometimes, yeah, without choice or poor choices.
Yeah.
So that was more the critical incident thing. And then there was the situation of the long-term work, case managing someone, which is, you know, unfolded so similar to the long-term work of, you know, on the surfing tour, people on a year world title campaign or qualifying for the world title tour, the top tier tour, or with Olympic, Paralympic campaigns that can go.
Yep.
Well, they're kind of a lifetime experience, but you know, that might be 4 to 6 year campaign.
Absolutely. Yeah.
To achieve selection and then go and deliver your PB in a game setting. So, and that's actually how I got into surf psychology, because, you know, we all have fears, and I love surfing and I wanted to surf bigger waves. So that was a fear that arose for me a lot. And so I was teaching people in Portland with panic disorder or anxiety or other fear-related experiences how to manage their fear, in situations that weren't directly relative to me. Like one gentleman I worked with had an anxiety attack in the supermarket around Christmas time, which I happened to just observe and help him out with, of course. But he was trying to choose whether he would buy his brother a green or a brown flannelette shirt for Christmas, and the decision making around that led to a panic attack. And I just happened to see him in the aisle I was Christmas shopping too, and just with a little bit of dialogue and refocus, he was able to compose and make his decision and let go of the outcome. His brother's going to like it or not.
Sure.
It's the intention and the loving gesture that's the important thing in that moment. So I started applying these mental strategies to myself to build my own confidence and have good decision making and composure in the intensity of big waves.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked very well, and that's how the whole career in surf psychology unfolded. Was I started writing articles about how to manage fear in big waves, how to use mind surfing or mental imagery to improve your surfing performance, understanding the flow state and relating that to tube riding, which is like the pinnacle of surfing.
Yeah, of course.
And there was a big pickup of that amongst recreational as well as some pro surfers on the tour at the time. So this is around 1999. And I ended up having a conversation with a guy called Robbie Bain, who was top five in the world, a Manly surfer, Aussie surfer. And he was saying, "Rich, you know, these articles you're writing, they're really practical. It's good, simple tips for even, you know, people at my level." But he said, "You know, we live the dream life. We're traveling the world surfing in great ways, but there's the background. And, you know, there's long distance relationships. There's not much prize money at this time. This is 20 years ago. You know, there's other hardships that the human is experiencing. And with that challenge, trying to perform was also sometimes more of a challenge, particularly mentally, where people can sometimes put more pressure on themselves. So it was kind of a light bulb moment. Combine your passions with surfing, your passions with psychology, and why not go on the pro surfing tour? And it hadn't been done before, and I put a proposal to the tour, and they came back and said, "Oh, we'd love to have you and your services on tour, but no one's thought of it. It's never been done. There's no budget, so... but if you want to come, the door's open." So I self-funded my first year, and in fact that's how it unfolded.
Yeah,
I was my own autonomous entity on the tour for the 4 years that I travelled full-time, and that really worked, because sometimes an athlete will come to me with a grievance around judging. And so if I was employed by the tour who employ the judges, there might have been some confusion or concern about talking to Richie around judging grievances, or sometimes there was sponsor negotiation or other media experience with sponsor or the media. So if I was employed by one of the major companies, then that might have created a challenge. So the surfers knew I was a vault and I was an autonomous entity, and that confidentiality, it's part of the backbone if you're practicing psychology, from mental health right through to performance. That's where it unfolded. It unfolded from my own self-study. I'm my first client in performance psychology. I still book in for sessions with myself, and that self-study and that process of experiential learning really has been how I've crafted my understandings of human nature, human potential and performance, whether it's about remaining composed while you're talking to your child around a behavioural issue, or whether it's about remaining composed on the 10-metre diving tower in Beijing.
So while we're talking about overcoming fear and performance related things, have you got any key insights or tips for what the best performers that you've worked with have adopted in terms of overcoming their fear? Thinking that most of our runners may experience this on the start line before the gun goes off.
Yeah, look, there's a fundamental across elite performance, but also across humanity. Any human that wants to, deal with a fear experience, we need to face it and we need to acknowledge it. And ideally it's good to acknowledge that with a sense of gratitude and appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways I share that understanding with people is that, you know, no one would choose physical pain, you know. But if you're running and you twist your ankle and you had no pain signal whatsoever, you would keep running. So what would happen to your ankle? The injury would become worse and worse and worse to the point where maybe it's a career-ending injury or it's a very long-term recovery from mm-hmm. that injury. Whereas if, because we receive this pain signal, which of course is a discomfort, but because we receive it, we stop, we observe, we attempt to seek deeper understanding. In other words, we feel the ankle out, and if it kind of feels okay, we might walk for a little while, see how that goes, get back to our run. Or we might go, oh, no, this, I really need to take care of this. So, you know, rest, ice, compression, elevation, see an appropriate sports professional that can assist you with your injury recovery process. And then you're back to running more quickly and more soundly. So, you know, that pain signal physically, you know, fear or other emotions that can arise, you know, they're a discomfort in the moment, mm-hmm. but they're also a divine message, like the pain mm-hmm. signal for the body.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's all about finding your fear, responding with love, and that's the path to transcend. Now, that love can be a very simple, practical thing,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's self-care or a smart decision or a shift in how I might breathe in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm starting to get quite anxious about something, my breathing changes. And I've become anxious because I've perceived a real or imaginary threat.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So, you know, that's where when the anxiety arises, having a moment to observe, well, what's the reason? And when I can observe that that's an imaginary threat, then I can let go of that.
Or
when I observe it's a real threat, a bit like the pain signal, oh, I really better seek some deeper understanding there. And, you know, surfers that surf extreme waves, it's very important that they respond to their fear experiences, because it's an emotion that is, you know, we're animals purpose-built to survive and thrive, and it's a survive emotion, at least in its original form. And so if I wasn't experiencing fear, I might be reckless, I might not attune to the conditions with the level of detail and the level of humility and the level of awareness that I need to be mm-hmm. safe and successful,
mm-hmm. yep.
to choose which waves are going to be makeable, which waves are not, to know the entry and exit zones, those kinds of things. And running is very similar, you know, because you have scenarios that, I mean, the marathon's a classic, where people might have in their mind this moment or at around about this distance, my discomfort tends to arise.
Yeah,
or it
sure.
might even be on the start line, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, for some people it yeah. might be a week or a day out and they don't sleep well because the anxiety, which oftentimes is actually just physiological activation that someone's chosen to label anxiety, you know, is compromising sleep, and then people can become very worried about what's going to happen tomorrow because I haven't had my good sleep tonight.
Sure, yeah. Mm. Absolutely.
Mm.
And I think in a competitive environment as well, the whole comparison syndrome, you know, oh gosh, they look fitter than me at the start line.
Yeah.
Oh wow, they look like they've lost a bit of weight or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That whole comparison thing. And I experienced this certainly within my running career. And I remember one of the greatest lessons that one of my competitors taught me was Dina Castor. She ran for America. She got a bronze medal actually in the Olympics, but I raced against her in Chicago, and she was incredible because she turned around at the beginning of the start line. We're all in this corral where we're all packed in, and she was you know,
yeah,
the key elite, and I was sort of not back of house, but I was B, so I was behind her. And she turned around and shook my hand. She noticed that I was an Australian, and she'd known everyone that was in this corral, and she knew them even by sight, even though we'd not introduced ourselves.
Mm.
And she turned around and shook my hand and said, "I hope you have a brilliant race." And that was her way of calming herself down.
Yeah.
It, you know, and demystifying that threat or that perception of, oh gosh, there's a new competitor here. I haven't seen that one before, you know.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting. And I've observed a lot of other athletes did that, especially under high pressure situations. And she needed to run particularly well that day to qualify for the Olympics. And she did that.
Yeah.
You know, she nailed it. I think she got course record that day and everything.
Yeah,
so it was like, wow, you know, something so simple as recognizing, oh, actually, we're all just humans and we're all just helping each other be the best that we can on the day rather than being competitors, you know what I mean? Yeah. One against the other.
Yeah.
And I think runners can sometimes get caught up in that, in that whole, no, we're competing. Well, actually, we're all just running.
Yeah,
it's very easy to get carried away with it.
Well, interestingly, humans can get carried away with that because we can lose sight that we're really just all ants on the anthill.
You know?
And so having a connection to the higher purpose here.
Yeah, you know, totally.
It's a little bit like with the AFL umpires. They have a competitive situation where there's 116 at the start of the season that do the 23 rounds.
Yeah.
But then only 44 of those umpires are chosen to do the finals. And, of course, the goal is to umpire a grand final across the three disciplines.
Yeah.
And so the higher purpose really is to deliver your umpiring with the highest quality and integrity for AFL. It's for the game. It's not for self in the beginning.
You know?
But of course, it's very important and it can actually enrich how you deliver to the higher purpose by having your own intention to fulfill your potential and personal best and the outcome targets you set yourself in terms of selection for finals and grand finals and things.
Sure.
So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. And, you know, potentially that runner, you know, that comes to our awareness of how we like to think and feel when we run at our best, you know, having happy communications with your fellow runners might be part of their way to achieve their ideal performance state. So that's another really important thing to consider as well. There might be some higher purpose as well as well. Yeah, some people like to talk, some people like to be inward.
Yeah, that's true.
To achieve their ideal performance state.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And you talk a lot in your Surface Mind book about tuning into your mind. Can you tell us what that really means?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like the mind is, it's simply a tool.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's given way too much credit and way too much power in our Western world as being something that controls things and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's a little bit like a puppy. If you bring a puppy home and you don't give it any training or attention, it'll just start tearing things up, digging holes, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And even though you're not wanting to do that, by its behaviour, it's controlling you now. Because mm-hmm. you have to respond to everything.
Yep.
Or it's going to tear the place to pieces, right?
Can relate to this one, for sure.
So the mind is very similar, where it's got an abundance of energy, of potential, of capability, of just beauty. And but if you don't give it any training, any love or attention, like the little puppy, it's just going to be something that causes you chaos and it gives you the perception or the actual day-to-day experience that you're just being controlled by your mind.
Mm.
Whereas when you give that little puppy even just a bit of love and attention,
mm-hmm.
you've got a best friend for life. So that's what I mean on I guess, an intimate level, you know, developing a relationship with your mind. You know, it's a little bit like a surfboard shaper. They're developed. They literally know the ins and outs of their planer.
Mm-hmm.
Or the painter with their palette and their brushes mm-hmm. and their paints. So there's all this beauty and potential with this tool, this mind. And then, of course, it will operate best with some love and attention, with some ideal guidance in terms of the training and for everyday life. You know, as a community, as a family, we learn values and principles and how we might communicate and get along with people. And then, of course, we have our activities of passion. For
mm-hmm.
me, it's surfing. For you guys, it's running.
Yeah.
Although I'm starting to get a little bit more passion for running now that my dog can outrun me by a mile. and so to tune your mind, it's like tuning the tool so that on the day you want to use it, it's sharp, it works, and it works how you want to use it. And as I'm sure all the listeners would know, running and all elite performance, it's all about energy. So if you've got a tool that's a bit blunt or a tool that's not, doesn't, you know, the angle of the blade's not ideal or something like that, you're going to have to keep going back to get it right. So if it's a bit blunt, it's going to like be a lot more energy to cut
or to finish that race.
So in other words, you know, your body basically in running is doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
It's the physicality of the running. So, but there's only one fuel tank for mind and body in my understanding. And so if your mind, which is basically luggage, just sitting on top of your shoulders there, it weighs a fair bit for its size too, you know, if we think of it physically, if that's using a lot of energy, like anxiety burns a huge amount more energy and a lot more quickly than anything you'll do physically, or if there's confusion and hesitation around decision making, if there's catastrophizing, such as, oh no, here comes a 30k mark in my marathon kind of thing, then your mind is now using more of that fuel, which means there's less available for the body. And the body's the instrument. The other tool, for me, again, the body's another tool. You know, they're both divine tools that are purpose-built to manifest the love and truth in our heart. And one of those loves or truths is our passion, and one of those passions might be running or surfing or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So they're just, you know, so to tune your mind is all about understanding, well, what's the beauty, what are the qualities, what are the potentials, the capabilities of my mind, and how do I want to attune that for the performance that I love? And for the quality of performance that I believe I'm capable of. And interestingly, a little bit like the puppy, they start to do behaviours that just blow your mind. You know, like my puppy was toilet trained in about 4 days. I couldn't believe it. And the other thing he did was just quite funny. He knows that I was teaching him that sticks and bones, he's an indoor-outdoor dog. He has the run of the house if he wants. But he knows that sticks and plant matter and bones, out. Right. So what he worked out was, because he likes to be inside, close to you if he can, he lies in the lounge with his head hanging out the door, chewing his bone and chewing his stick.
Oh, classic.
And, you know, so it's a great example where, like, my conditioning, if you like, or my training of my dog, you know, it comes primarily from the intention of kindness.
Yeah.
So whatever behaviour is happening,
yeah,
the response is always kindness in language, in behaviour, in action. And, and I feel, you know, along with that being a natural part of the heart and my values as a person, when it's about elite performance, being kind to yourself is very, very important.
Oh, it's a lot,
you know, like that story that you just shared about the runner on the start line.
Yeah.
A gesture of kindness would have been an invigoration for that person.
Absolutely.
Rather than the mental war of who's this, what's going to happen, this day is so important to me, who, you know.
Yes.
That's a lot more energy. So, yeah, when you tune your mind, it's going to work efficiently as well as very well. And that efficiency side is so important for your energy management, which is such a huge part of your running.
Yeah, that's great. And you talk a lot about routine as well, and I think most listeners understand a little bit about routine, and some of them may have one. Why is it so important to have a routine?
Well, a lot of my understandings about human nature come from Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And Mother Nature has some routines, you know.
Absolutely.
We've just moved out of winter and into summer. We're grabbing the cap or the hat instead of the beanie more often now as we walk out the door.
Yep.
So, you know, actions change because of the change in season, and the change in our routine. Thinking changes and that kind of thing. So, interestingly, you can start at the end and work backwards with your routines too. So what I mean by that is having a really good understanding of your ideal performance state. What do I like to focus on? How do I like to feel? And for me, the mind works best when we keep things simple. So I don't, you know, really guide people into too much more detail than, well, how do you like to feel? What do you like to focus on? And then it's like, well, how do I cultivate that feeling?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the smart things to focus on, and then what might be my routine? And you know, it's good to have a couple of routines. You know, you'll have your week leading in, say, or it might even be a little bit of a longer lead in, depending on you know, how you like to go. I don't think there's anything right or wrong with that, just how you like to go. But there's the week leading in. Quite often there's the night before to have, you know, some element of check-in.
Mm-hmm. And then get the gear out and have everything sorted and that side of things.
Pack your wax, pack your leg rope, or, you know, you guys, your runners, your laces, that kind of stuff.
Everything's checked.
And, you know, doing that, often doing that, say, before dinner, because then dinner's like a ritual that you can just really enjoy with self or with whomever's there, and the rest of the night is your own peace and however you'd like to experience that, rather than the mind starting to run the race.
Okay.
I remember when I was working with the marathon runners leading into Beijing, the Paralympic team, I was working with a couple of the runners that had vision impairments. I was them and their pilot. And we're doing a training camp about 6 months out, and I just noticed how much in the training camp, you know, around the brekkie table, around the lunch table, just, you know, even around the training, just how much dialogue was continually going on about the running and what was going to happen here, what was going to happen there. So there wasn't really a dial down or a switch off when the spaces were appropriate to do that.
Right.
So I said to the coach, I've got a little strategy I'd like to do with the runners just before they do their morning run today. Do you mind? And he's like, yeah, that'd be unreal. So what I said to them, was, you know, the night before, we're going to be doing a little psych strategy before the training run in the morning. So I'd all like you to just arrive about 30 minutes earlier than, you know, what the coach, so I've vacated with the coach, or call it like, oh yeah, okay. So, you know, they all arrive 30 minutes early for their running training that's going to happen. And I said, now what I'd like you all to do is 1500 meter sprints. I want you to do 1500s. And they just looked at me like I was a lunatic, which, you know, quite a lot of athletes yeah. have looked at me like that before.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? See, I want you to, you know, I got the clock.
Yeah.
And I just want you to do 1500s.
Yeah.
And I'll give you 60 seconds rest and we'll see how many 1500s you can do in 30 minutes until the coach arrives and you can start your running training.
Yep.
Just like, are you sure? How's this? What's the mental strategy? And I said, well, it's not so much a mental strategy, it's an understanding.
Okay.
What I've observed you guys doing is basically running this whole camp. You know, what are you going to do in the Paralympic Village when you're there?
Yeah.
Your marathon's the last day.
Yeah.
You got 12, 14 days.
Yeah.
So what you've been doing is mentally running it. If you've got one fuel tank, you get to the start line.
You're done. Half done. Yeah.
So, you know, it's no different to if you actually physically went out and did those 1500s with a 60-second break for the next 30 minutes, how are you going to feel on the start line when the coach arrives for training? You've already, you know, you've already used your fuel. You're already burnt. So it was a really good awakening for them to realise that. You
know, you've got to mentally switch off as well.
Yeah. That's right. And so, again, this is where a mental preparation routine can be so fantastic, because – one of the reasons people don't switch off is they're worried about how, if they're going to switch on, you know, or they feel like they need to just have their head in the race or in the game for a period of time. But that's burning very valuable fuel, very valuable energy.
Yeah, you know, totally.
It was a really good experience on the surfing tour as well, because the World Tour events, they were anything from 10 to 14 days for a 3-day event, so they could cherry pick the best surf conditions. Mm-hmm. So you literally had 7 a.m. call. Sometimes it was, we'll have a look at 9, we'll have a look at 11, but basically you had a situation where you didn't know your start time. And if you were first heat of the day that day, you would only have about a 30-minute lead-in to get ready. So it was imperative. And, you know, sometimes things can unfold, like traffic or a bus being late or some marshalling or other kind of thing going on at the actual event that delays what's going on for you. So to be able to gift yourself with a real nice little space while this hold-up is unfolding is very important, rather than, again, maintaining that energy use with trying to be in a certain way. So to have a mental preparation routine, particularly one that's really quite simple and just has those targets, what's my ideal focus, what's my ideal feeling, and you play around with that so that you know that you can do that in your ideal time, you know, usually like say 20, 40 minutes, wherever it might be, or you can do it in 2 minutes because something may unfold that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a confidence builder, because now I'm not concerned that things have to unfold perfectly for me to run perfectly.
Yes.
I'm ready.
Yeah.
I'm ready for anything.
Yeah, so, cool.
And that sense of readiness, that's how we step into the unknown, isn't it? You know, we've got the known and the unknown. So this is how we transcend. Another way of transcending fear is we consolidate the known. That builds confidence, but it also builds readiness, and we're on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not, you know, now we're ready to actually have a go. We don't know what's going to happen, but we've got all we know and a sense of readiness to step over.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Which is, ironically, when you look back, that's what personal best is. My best time is the edge of what I know, because that's all I've ever done before.
Absolutely, yeah.
But a PB is stepping over the edge, because I've never been there before.
Yeah.
So interestingly, you know, it's something that people fear a lot, is actually what we desire the most.
Yeah, true.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Because that's
amazing.
That's life as well.
And for those listeners who have been doing more Australian-based races as well. Even the difference between a recreational race, for example, a big city marathon that we have in Australia, is so completely different than if you stepped into something like New York or London or any of those big city marathons, where you are literally standing around for 4 or 5 hours in the cold. And if you've only ever practiced having your own little hour of luxury doing what you could be thrown in that new environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I personally experienced that as well when I'd always been doing big city marathons, even in, you know, over in US and Japan, in that when you step into an Olympic experience or a major championship, it's even more controlled. You know, you're given 100 metres to warm up in. You're given 15-minute blocks and you have to check in, and you have four uniform checks. It's like you checked this like 15 minutes ago, you know, and it's all that unknown. So if you, if you've got your, as you say, your mental prep that you can fast track in 2 minutes, it's a great strategy for people, because I think a lot of the time people get concerned, I won't get enough warm up, or, you know, something left of centre happens. They've got an upset tummy, so they need to spend most of their warm-up at the bathroom. You know, and it happens so often. But just being able to keep calm, even when that, you know, environment unfolds, is just, you know, it's a gem, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think one of the attachments, and it's a lot because of a lot of the research in sports psychology, actually the dialogue talks a lot about mental toughness and mental strength, or the literature, you know, has researched mental toughness a lot, and so the dialogue is a lot around that, but for me the more important thing is you know, mental smarts, that you're making good decisions, because as you would know with running, I certainly know this with surfing and other performances as well, there's such an art, there's such a subtlety, such a grace and such a beauty to your running cadence, to the feeling, to, you know, the rhythm of your breath and all these kinds of things. So making a smart decision to be gentle, to be calm, to be kind, is actually really an important part of your mental game, of tuning this mind, this tool you have, just as important as being able to just use the mind to lift the body when you really need the mind to help you here. To really be strong. So there's certainly times where the mind needs to be really strong, at least as strong as the body, because, yeah, the body's got its own system where, it, you know, it has moments where it needs a, you know, nice kind word and a pat on the back. And let's go. You've got this. You know?
I'm with you.
I'm with you. So, so mind and body, you know, while I see them as two tools, they're very much one.
Absolutely.
One in terms of the synergy and the ability to deliver.
Fantastic. Now, you also talk a little bit about vigor and arousal concepts. Can you explain what that means in terms of running? Like, how could runners actually apply that in their context?
Yeah, well, looking at arousal first, when I look at arousal, like I actually use the word now activation, because I feel like it's just a little bit more objective, and there's other associations to the word arousal that people can trail off to. And of course, that is an example of the power of self-talk. You know, words have power. You know, they're like a ripple that goes through every cell of your body. You know, if I say I can't, my whole body, the consciousness in every cell is just going, what? You know, but when I say I can, every cell in your body is going, let's go.
Cool.
You know? So that's, I guess, a way I've evolved with my psychology, is just the attunement to the language and the quality of the language, you know, with the intention of the message. So arousal for me is about activation. And, you know, I guess a classic example in running is you've got your sprinters to your long distance. So the level of activation for a sprinter, what they generate and deliver in a briefer moment, it's going to be quite different to the endurance runner that's going to have, say, a base level of activation to keep the rhythm that they want, and then have movement spurts with that at different times.
Yep.
And then, you know, actually maybe lift the gear and maintain that gear now.
Yeah, sure.
Maintain that gear now. So obviously, being a psychologist, the mental arousal side comes back to that energy element. So I can be mentally very activated, but physically quite composed. Again, think of a parent in the aisle of a supermarket, you know, with a kid that's misbehaving. You know, their mind is just very intense, but they're trying to physically keep calm, and because they're in a public space, but also role modelling that may assist the young child to calm down or whatever it might be. And then, of course, we can do the other way, which is ideal for running. You know, you can have your system highly activated while your mind is quite calm. So when I talk about arousal in the book, which I talk more activation now, it's being able to firstly know when it's ideal and what the balance is, and then know how to get there, how to be there. And interestingly, I mean, nature's such a divine creator. We've been created to breathe different ways for activation, you know. And I watch animals a lot. When you see your pet dog or cat or asleep, you know, it's what part of their body is moving their breath. And obviously sleep is our deepest, most serene moment. And so the way nature designed us to breathe is going to be in harmony with being calm and serene. And what we find is that they'll nostril breathe and they'll move the breath, or the movement of the diaphragm comes from below. So these things can be pretty hard and might not be appropriate, say, in a sprint. So you got to look at, well, what are my performance demands and how can I use what I've got, which is my nature's design, and then what might I need to tinker and play around with because of the actual demands of this elite performance, you know. But I feel like it's always a good idea to start with what you're given, which is nature's design. And in a very simplistic way, we nostril breathe and move the breath from below the diaphragm to calm the system, to compose the system. And then we can still nostril breathe, but you'll probably mouth breathe more when you really want it.
When you're kicking up a gear.
It'll be your thoracic that moves the diaphragm. Because, all the hard wiring, in a simplistic way, the hard wiring for your sympathetic nervous system, the activating part of your nervous system, is all up in the thoracic. When that's moving, it's like the gorilla or the lion blowing right up to deal with the competitor of the group, or that kind of thing. And then, when we're asleep or we're cruising, the parasympathetic nerves are all wired below the diaphragm in mammals. So, and of course, nostril breathing, that's immediately going to slow down and decrease the volume of air, because your nostrils are small and they don't change in size, whereas I can, in one breath, 6 litres in a second kind of thing, and oxygen's energy as well as stimulating that sympathetic nervous activity. So arousal or activation is really about understanding what's going to be the ideal level of activation for your race, and that's going to be different from a sprint to a marathon or ultra-endurance kind of running. So you want to play around with that, and you also want to know, you know, when you really become in tune with yourself and how you draw the best out of yourself for your running, that you can perhaps be at a different level of activation than you thought. You know, when you start to play around with your breath, it's actually amazing how much output you can have physically with little input. And of course, again, that comes back to efficiency and good energy management. So that's the arousal or the activation side. And then in my book, you know, I look at confidence, I look at fear, I look at these classic feelings or emotions that we have in performance. But I chose, when I was looking at the section about your emotions, to firstly look at the activation or arousal part, because emotions move up and down in terms of that too. You know, frustration, anger, fear, anxiety, they're classically activated experiences, you know, when we have those emotions in our system. When, when I feel confident and I've got that deep trust and knowing, I'm going to be less activated, at least on a mental level, because I have this trust that I've done the work, or this trust that I'm in a good place, or this trust that my body's just feeling good, so let's go. So when I looked at the emotion side, I thought I'll look at vigor, because that's been looked at a lot in sports psychology literature. But for me, again, just in a simplistic way, it's like the spark. Vigor's like a spark, you know. And again, whether you're sprinting, you're doing marathons, you're doing ultra endurance, whatever kind of distances and demands you've got with your running, a spark's really important, you know, because it's going to open up your consciousness and your alertness of mind and your clarity of mind. And of course, you know,
and also your commitment to what you're actually about to end. engage in.
Yeah.
You know, if you're half asleep, well, hey.
Yeah. And that's a really good point, Kate, because sometimes your commitment might be to the intention of your race, which might not be to win, it might be to raise money for someone that you love that's having a hard time. Or,
yeah.
You know, so that spark, you know, when you come to those points in your running where the body's really feeling it, or some, you know, dialogues or thoughts are coming into your mind that aren't in harmony with helping you run, you know, when you generate a sense of vigor, it's going to kind of blow that out again, and it's like a restart. And there's a few ways to do that, and interestingly, one of them can be with your body, and often it's a really good way to, the body is like a guru to the mind. You know, I used the example earlier in our chat today about the pain signal, the physical pain signal being a learning for the fear experience.
Yep.
And you know, other ways that the body can be such a beautiful guru for the mind is when you move your body, you move your mind.
Sure, yeah.
And so my posture and my facial expression has quite a bearing on my emotional experience and my thinking in that moment. So I can have a mindful, you know, my mind's going to be involved in this, but I can help to move my mind without doing all this mental work of trying to, you know, overdo self-talk to feel better. I can literally just check in with my hips. What's the integrity and positioning of my hips?
Uh-huh.
You know, I can check in with my shoulders while I'm running.
Yeah.
I might even just want to check in with my, you know,
footfall.
My footfall, my connection with the earth, you know, my connection with something greater than me.
Yeah, so it's really being mindful in that moment.
Yeah.
Bring you back down.
Yeah.
Rather than getting carried away around, oh, what are my splits at? And, you know, how far in head or behind I am. Yeah, just right there in the moment, you're capturing it.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, when we're being mindful like that in the present moment, the mind is using minimal energy.
Mm.
But interestingly, it's so clear and it's so sharp and it's so easy for it to work.
Yeah.
And when it's on something as beautiful and important with our performance as our hip positioning, our footfall, where our shoulders might be, just a postural element, it might even be about softening the features of our face.
Because,
You know.
Yeah, there's a lot of strain sometimes on people's faces, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
A friend of mine calls it melanitis, where, you know, melon being your head, you know, inflamed. Like, and this is from surfing. He's a surfing buddy, because sometimes when you're in a pretty intense moment surfing, your face is all screwed up or your mouth's wide open, you're catching flies. So he was saying, oh, you had a bit of melanitis on that wave.
Yeah, right.
Because you were just so freaked out
about intense,
the intensity. But when you let go, like, the face softens. So why not be intentional about that, you know? And particularly if there are moments in your racing, your running, where you do tend to have a little bit more discomfort, you know, it's, well, how might you prepare for that? So sometimes there's a pre-race routine, but there's also, well, this is my intention for when, if and when that moment arises.
Yep.
And then it can often shift to if it arises, because I'm not preempting it anymore.
I'm
also not concerned that if it does arise, well, I've got an approach anyway.
So it's about if, not...
People can get stuck, and it is interesting because it's part of our nature, like we touched on before. We're creatures of habit, routines are really useful. We have night and day, we have the seasons, and then humans, we have our own rhythms, whether it's your digestion and elimination, whether it's your circadian rhythm. So it's quite natural, but we can play around with that, can't we? You know, if we become jet lag, we can change our circadian rhythm. You know, like we can change our rhythm through a running race. It doesn't always have to be how it's started to unfold. And that, you know, if my preparation routine for a race is unfolding the same page in the same book and rereading it from when it doesn't go well, that's most likely what I'll experience. You know, you can literally step by step create a new page or a new race, really.
Yeah, totally. And it's all learning.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, some of the things that you've just touched on are some of the questions that we've actually had from some listeners in advance. So thank you very much, guys, for sending in your questions. We might actually divert to that, Rich, if that's okay now, because I think we're sort of primed for sharing some of those key tips that I know are on the tip of your tongue. But perhaps if we kick off with, we've got so many good questions here, and you've just talked about routine. Someone's asked, what happens if you've got a routine you follow for a race day, but then it gets changed? Would you like to answer that one?
Yeah, okay.
What happens when it just goes haywire? What are some of, maybe some of the things that you can do to kind of deal with that? And that's really keeping that flexibility, and it's almost the mastery that we talked about as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. I'm going to give this question context because I'm not sure if it means the marshals at the race changed the schedule.
Oh, I think
so
it's more.
So I now have to readjust.
Yeah, right.
Or something within my preparation changed because, you know, I've got diarrhea. I've got, you know,
I think it's more likely going to be the latter.
Yeah.
When your routine gets blown out of the...
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, when your own... Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, change is wonderful. You wouldn't achieve PBs if change didn't happen.
Yeah.
So the reason I start there is because our big picture view on self and performance is really, really important. And quite often, you know, because in the moment with this question, something's changed. So what's going to happen to my thoughts, you know? And if my thoughts, big picture, are things have to be a certain way, then by design, by my own mental design, when things unfold differently, my thinking's now lost at sea. It's now potentially random and scattered, or it's really disrupted and it can be catastrophic, you know, anxious, that kind of thing. So that big picture view on self and performance is really, really important. And the classic example I see in sport is you know, the big picture approach of perfectionism. And interestingly, it will certainly assist people to get a fair way, but I don't know about the whole way. In fact, I've never really seen it get the whole way. And you know, one of the real ideal intentions with our passions and our sport is longevity. And you know, you want to be able to surf as long as you can. You want to be able to run at your highest level for as long as you can.
Absolutely.
At least have to enjoy it. So perfectionism is one of those saboteurs for longevity, particularly on the mental side, because perfectionism has a big picture perspective on self and performance. You know, it's got some great values. People with a perfectionist approach will have a high attention to detail. They'll have very clear targets and goals. They'll have the inner drive to perfect what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
But and this is one of the reasons longevity can suffer. It's not an if, it's a when an error or a change, as the question raises, happens. The perfectionist can have quite a dramatic, uncomfortable response to that because it's now not perfect. So even subconsciously, the thinking can be, so my performance can't be perfect. And then that's very worrying. And then if I'm worried, well, that's not an ideal feeling to go run my race. I want to feel happy or energized or vigor or whatever kind of feeling is my ideal feeling. So that big picture view of perfectionism, it has some values and qualities that does assist performance. And people, you know, the other sports where there is a 10, you know, there's surfing and gymnastics and things like that, the people I work with in those sports, there is an outcome judge of or score of that's considered perfection. But the actual process of delivery is rarely perfect. And so what we want to do is we want to have a big picture view of self and performance and the realities that can happen, which things can change, that fits reality and serves my potential. And one that I talk with people a lot and spend time cultivating with people, it includes the values of perfectionism, but not the other side.
So, for example,
I talk to people about the mastery approach. Now, a master will have a very high attention to detail. A master will have very clear targets and intentions of what they'd like to do. A master has a lot of inner drive and desire to master their craft, master their performance. However, the master has the humility and understanding to know that it's not an if, it's a when. Things will change. I will make errors. So what they do is they spend time developing, mastering the response to those realities that will unfold at some point in their running career, their surfing career, their activity of passion. And now that you've got a bit more of a complete package, haven't you? Because you are still doing all the good things. And at the same, and then of course, you know, leading into your race and your preparation, it's all about creating ideal mindset, ideal body preparation, ideal race strategy to deliver personal best. So it's all still about performing to your peak. But we feel more comfortable and we have that deeper, you know, this is where confidence goes even deeper, to just trust and knowing. Because when I know I have a response to change, to unforeseen situations, that's going to be a minimal little blip, not a tsunami, you know, then, you know, I know that I've got this.
I can
adapt to anything that will arise.
Yeah.
And the other part about mastery, which I feel is really important for, well, all humans, but, you know, in elite performance, it's also one of the elements of having an activity of passion that I think is just absolutely wonderful, is that it's a space for self-study. You know, it's a space to learn and understand more about yourself, to go, well, isn't that great that I've been such a perfectionist and it's got me this far, and here's the values. So, you know, it's not baby out with the bathwater. It's, well, I'm going to continue to nurture these values. You know?
Yeah.
So you're reflecting on who you are as a human and what you've brought to your running that's served your potential to this point. But when you're wanting to go a little further, the self-study, a mastery approach, not just to running but to self, means that you'll start to discover elements such as, you know, in the perfectionist approach, the blinkers can be on. Like I shared before, the disruption when an error occurs can be quite dramatic.
Can rattle you,
You're starting to understand yourself at a deeper level. And going, well, you know, here's things that I could transform or let go of.
Mm-hmm.
And what that is going to do is open another door to my potential. And importantly, it's going to mean that my perspective on self and the world and my performance fits reality.
Yeah.
Whereas you know, being perfect all
rather
the time,
rather than being unrealistic. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
yeah, totally. And I think a lot of runners tend to have that almost addiction to PBs, and they expect, oh, I'm going to be running faster in this race, and it's very much about that perfectionist. You know, I will be running this time, and I will. You know, it's not reality of how it.
And for me, it spans out. I'm not a runner at elite level or anything, and never have been. I'm more like a turtle. I paddle all day. And that's actually a pretty good description of my running style too. But, you know, if you look at any stats, like running looks at data a lot, and because it's very easy to quantify. And if there are things that resonate for you, that's great.
Mm.
You just want to keep them in context, because there's other stats out there, isn't there? So if you look at Federer's first serves in for his whole career, it's not 100%.
Mm.
Or Serena Williams, as first says, in her whole career, it's not 100%. If you look at Kelly Slater with 11 world titles and the, you know, most successful competitive surfer of all time, I reckon he's had, you know, less than 2010s his whole career.
Mm.
You know, and I do know for a fact, because I've been on the beach at the time, he said, "Oh, I'm happy. I'll take that 10," because he didn't think it was.
Yeah, right.
Because he's so attuned to what his level of performance and what he knows would really be a 10.
Yeah.
And then other times, you know. But if the scale had 11, then he would have got an 11 too.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So what's perfect? Perfect is fixed. Why can't it even be better?
Yeah.
That's the other restriction of perfection. That's the blinkers on the other side, that it's got to be like this. Where the master allows, firstly, mastery is a continuum. Perfection's, you know, an input, an outcome.
Almost static,
fixed thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I use the word perfect more as an adjective to describe something that's happened. Oh, that was a perfect wave. But I can tell you, the moment I've ridden it, I'm paddling pretty fast to catch a better one, you know.
Yeah.
So you had the perfect performance, you want to run faster next time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was only a moment of time. Whereas mastery, like life, is a continuum. So if you've got a mastery approach to your running, to your self-study, then you're in tune with the reality that you're on a...
Yeah.
You're living and breathing moment to moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think one of our running colleagues that I think everyone will know quite well is Steve Monteghetti, and he has a great saying that you're certainly only ever as good as your last race, but also all of your training is more like pages in your book.
Mm.
You know, and you're all just forming chapters.
Yeah.
You're not just one race. So don't put all your eggs in that one basket. Keep evolving, keep continuing, and love the process of running rather than just the outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I really resonated with that when Mona told me about that. So we've got a little bit of time to cover just a couple more questions. How about if Olivia has sent in a couple of questions. Thanks, Olivia. Olivia's asked, at what level should you see a sports psychologist? Did you want to answer that, Rich? I could answer from an athlete perspective.
How about we both we both share our experiences.
Would you like to go first?
If you like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, isn't the body a beautiful guru for the mind? So what would happen to your body if you started running and the quality and integrity of that biomechanical movement was low, was poor? It was low quality running technique. And you kept on with that. What would happen?
An injury.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now, the mind moves in patterns as well. So if I have a low, if I have low quality thinking, then eventually that's going to cause mental injury. In this case, in sport, quite often it's just, you know, repeated sub-performance and then pretty harsh on self. And, you know, basically it's low quality thinking. So, you know, for me, any time really is a good time to seek guidance on ideal thinking and ideal development and attunement of our mind. And I actually do a lot of work with entry-level people and recreational people because they want to have – the entry-level people that have intentions for a career in running, you know, they want to start with the ideal technique. You know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a number of runners out there that have had the experience of, you know, midway or some point through their career – a coach that saw something that no one else saw said, oh, hey, you know, have you really checked your technique here? And the challenge that you go through to shift a physical movement technique can be quite, you know, very challenging and take a long period of time. So ideally you're setting, training the mind, building movement patterns or thinking patterns, belief systems, perspectives on performance as early as you can, because then you're actually...
Yeah, you've got time to master them and practice them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's some classic situations. You know, if people are finding that they do have a pattern of performance that they, in their own intuitive sense, just isn't fulfilling their potential, or the outcomes are pretty clear as well. You know, it's always good to look at your mind. It's for me, the mind might be a bit biased here, but when it's about delivering your performance in the moment, it has such a huge impact on that because there's not much increment of change you can achieve in the status of your physical system on the start line.
And
there's not much increment of change you can create in terms of the quality of your skills and your technique and that on the start
line.
The
work's already done. Yeah.
But the shift you can have mentally moment to moment can be huge.
Yeah.
And if my mind, you know, if my mind's 100% open for performance, but then I start thinking about the past in an uncomfortable way, gee, I didn't do well last week, start thinking about the future, oh, what's going to happen at the 800 mark or something like this, or I'm not even kind of there, I'm thinking about something that's unrelated, what have I got to do, I've got to buy the kids this after the race, you know, then now my mind's 20% free and open to do the role that it actually has on race day, which is harmonise my body, my skills, the energy management to deliver my running, to run to my full potential. So if my mind's only 20% free and open to do its job, what's the potential of my running that day? It's around about 20%.
Yeah, good
Whereas,
point.
You know, when my mind is actually quite free, quite open, I'm in the moment, I am trusting in my preparation. If something out of the blue has unfolded, I'm trusting in my error response or my how I adapted to that. My mind's 100% free and open. Then what's the potential of my performance in that moment on that day? It's now 100%, but interestingly, it's also a little more because this is where the intuition really kicks in, because I don't have to think as much about my running now. I can feel.
Yep, and you go on autopilot.
That's right, and the intuition is the highest level of our mental game. It's also, interestingly, the most efficient, so we can, you know, use far less energy being intuitive than being cognitive. And so that's really where PB is available, when my mind's 100% free and open. And I'm sure there's a few runners out there that have achieved PB when the physical system was not 100%.
Yeah, and they've surprised themselves, absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. And quite often it's, oh, I've got no chance to do anything today. So everything cognitively switched off and they've just gone into the field.
Yes, yes, yes. And I won't nominate a well-known Australian runner that used to coach me, actually, who shared a terrific story about how he set his national record 5K after a big night out, because he just, you know, he was in that...
Let it go.
Yeah. Just let it just turn up. And, that happened for him. And there's many stories like that, actually. Thanks, Rich. We'll just go to maybe the final question. And that's a question that someone sent in, and they've asked, what's the best way to deal with not achieving your target or goal? How do you deal with it when you just didn't quite come up to scratch?
Yeah, mental recovery and reviewing our performance is such a big part of that. That was one of the biggest changes or interventions that I noticed and we put in place between Beijing and London with the Paralympic team that I was working with was that the way people were recovering mentally was a continuation of the worry and the replay of the performance, the replay of the error and over again. And then, of course, if you need to deliver again later that day or the next day or next week or something, you've used energy, you know, and of course your mindset's, you know, in a darker place instead of a lighter place to do your performance anyway. So when it comes to particularly elite performance, but again, with entry-level runners and athletes of all levels, I have what I just call the rule of three in terms of my performance review.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like to do, the rule of three is, first thing we look at is, well, what are three strengths that I, or what are three things I did really well today?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we might not have achieved the outcome. You know, any time we do any performance, we're either going to under-deliver, deliver on potential, or over-deliver, PB, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it might be under potential on the day. So that might still be the reality, but you want to start with at least three things that you did well. Might have been my couple of days lead-in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because what can happen is we can get so fixed on that mistake that we forget that there's a lot of our package, and any performance, it's a package, it's not just one little piece. It's actually really good. So, you know, you want to pick out, you want to identify and really acknowledge and understand three or more strengths, things you did well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you want to look at a maximum of three things that potentially didn't go well or you didn't execute well. And the reason I would go say a maximum is there's a few reasons actually. One is that we can really go into a huge amount of detail, whereas again the mind works best when we keep things simple, and ideally we want the most simple detail that has the domino effect to correct everything else as well. You know,
yeah.
Surfing's a classic example. You could look at video replay of your top turnout, the top of the lip of the wave, over and over again, and you could pick out so many different things: biomechanically, the, you know, your position of your feet on the board, the position of the board on the wave. You go into so much detail, but really every maneuver in surfing requires speed.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
because that's how you're going to get in and out of a critical section that's critical energy of nature,
right?
That's not going to stop for you. Like, you've got to get in and out, do a big turn or whatever. So and running's the same, and other performances are the same, where when you become attuned to the one or two things that are the really important things to change, improve, or let go of, then you've now opened up the performance again, and there'll be a ripple effect or a domino effect of the detail. So if I've got speed of my bottom turn, I'm going to be much more likely to get everything right in the top turn. So I, at least that's what I need to be doing. I need to be getting the speed off the bottom and trusting off the top, because it's a spontaneous thing. So the other reason, you know, and I look at strengths first or things I did well, is because that's going to shift the goalposts in terms of perspective. Because people go straight to what I didn't do well, and they can really stay there and get stuck there.
Yeah.
So it's not just to prop up my mood a bit and that kind of thing. It's actually really quite intentional. You know, it's a little bit like teaching a young person how to a brand new skill. Of course they're going to make errors. They're going to make lots of errors. If we focus on that, what's going to happen to their motivation, their confidence, their preparedness to have another go?
Probably repeat it again.
Oh, you know, that's really cool, Kate. Your feet are in the right position. You've got good stability. You know, just, you know, move the bat this way. And so, you know, there was more talk then on what you've done, and then just move the bat this way, you know, because your stability's good and all that. And so you're looking at what's going on. So this is, again, where that kindness, that gentleness, you know, this mental smarts is very important, because that way we're not, you know, beating ourselves up and being too hard on ourselves, but we are still being very realistic and attuned to what we're doing well and then what we could change, improve, let go. So you might have noticed I don't say weaknesses. There might have been an error or a mistake, but when it's about how I'm going to review and respond to this, it's about change, improve, let go.
Yeah.
Because they're objective things, and they're tangible. You know.
Yeah,
sure. Practical things that I'll do. I'll change my routine. I'll play around with some self talk, or I'll improve my self talk, or I'll just let go of that because it was an addition, or I'm doing more than I need to. I could simplify this.
Right. Yeah.
And that's an interesting experience that you see with the best performers, is that they've actually got something very complex, very simple.
Yeah.
You know, they've understood, they've gone through this whole process, a lot of what we've talked about today, to simplify what they do so they can execute at the highest level on demand, which is really important.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. I think that might be all we've got time for. I'm sorry. I think I could sit here and chat to you all day, Rich. You're an absolute amazing encyclopedia.
thank you, Kate.
So thank you so much for joining us today for this edition of Inside Running. We were very lucky to have Rich Bennett here. If any of the listeners would like to actually know more about what Rich has spoken about today or shared today, Rich, do you want to tell people how they maybe get in contact with you? Because you do private consultation as well.
Yeah, I've been in private practice for about 20 years now, and I consult locally, in person, globally, by data call, phone. I've been doing that for a very long time. And people can very simply contact me through my website, richiebennett.com. My mobile's there, my email's
there. Yep, everything's on richiebennett.com.
Yeah, it shares a little bit about the performance psychology, the surf psychology, the mentoring that I do with performers. And yeah, I actually don't really call myself a sports psychologist because it's really so much more than sport that I work on, even with athletes, but so many other performance domains that I work in. And yeah, people can have a look at my books there as well. And
great.
Yeah, always welcome.
Awesome.
Inquiries.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Thanks again. And all the best with your running.
Yeah, happy running, everyone.